Good morning, everyone.
We are approaching the end of Canto 6 of Book 2. We stopped on page 196, line 832. We're reading about the goddess or the life force of the greater life. Sri Aurobindo says her vision climbs beyond her act. She sees high possibilities which she's not able to achieve. A demigod, a half god, emerging from an ape is all she can in our mortal element. That's all she has been able to achieve in the present level of human evolution. Here, the half god, the half titan are her peak. This greater life wavers twixt earth and sky. A poignant paradox pursues her dreams. Her hooded energy moves an ignorant world to look for a joy her own strong clasp puts off. In her embrace, it cannot turn to its source. She impels us to look for higher light and love and bliss, but this clasp of life prevents us from achieving those things. She's holding us tight, so we can't achieve those heavenly joys she inspires us to aspire for.
She turns love.
Life. The greater life. There are outstanding beings in human form who embody this greater life power. They're often very, very creative beings, great artists, writers, achievers of different kinds, or they may be just the opposite. They may be rajasic powers doing harm wherever they can. But anyway, that greater life power, it says she wavers between earth and sky. Poignant paradox pursues her dreams. And this paradox is that her hooded energy, her energy which is cowled and hidden, it is moving an ignorant world, our world, to look for a joy that her own strong clasp puts off. She inspires us to look for a higher forms of delight, but her own clasp, her hold on us is such that we can't achieve those things that she is dreaming of and making us dream of. This ignorant world, in her embrace, it cannot turn to its source, the source of all delight. You would read, Franz?
Immense her power, endless her acts, fast drive. The strain is its significance and loss. Also she carries in her secret breast the lobe and yearning curve of all things born. Her knowledge partial seems, her purpose small. On a soil of yearning tread her sumptuous hours. A little nescience waits the wings of thought. Her power oppresses the being with its guards. Her action prison its immortal gaze. A sense of limit haunts her masteries, and nowhere is assured content or peace. For all the depth and beauty of her work, the wisdom lacks that sets the spirit free. An old and faded charm that now her face, and pallid for him her quick and cautious law. His wide soul asked a deeper joy than hers.
Yes. So this is now back to King Aswapati. He realizes how immense is the power of this life force, her endless, vast drive, but its significance is astray, lost. It doesn't know where it is going. In fact, he realizes this life force does carry in her secret breast the law, the awareness of the journeying curve of all things born, the destiny of earthly creatures. But her knowledge seems to be partial, incomplete. her purpose small and limited. She may create sumptuous hours, but they are based on this base of yearning, of longing, dissatisfaction. The wings of thought which she inspires are weighed down by this heavy, leaden nescience, lack of knowledge which goes with matter. Her power oppresses the being, the inner being, the Purusha within. Her power oppresses the being with its garbs, all its coverings. Her actions imprison its immortal gaze. She doesn't allow the innermost being spirit to be free.
That's it.
That is it. Yes, the being. Yes. In line 846, her power oppresses the being. So all her great masteries and achievement, they're still haunted by this sense of limit, and nowhere is assured content or peace. And that is because, despite all the depth and beauty of her work, a wisdom lacks. That wisdom that would set the spirit free is missing. So as Asvapati perceives all this, whatever attraction this great force had for him is lost. An old and faded charm had now her face and palled for him. When something palls for you, you lose interest in it. You're no longer impressed or attracted. Her quick and curious lore, all her learning and achievement, this is no longer appealing for him. His wide soul asks for a deeper joy than hers. So we can see that Asvapati is going to have to move beyond this kingdom of the greater life. It is no longer satisfying for him, just as we saw him leaving the world of subtle matter. Would you read, please?
Out of her level lines he sought escape, neither gate, horn, nor ivory. He found no postern of spiritual sight. There was no issue from that dream-like space, turning through time. Death helps us not. Vain is the hope to cease. A secret will compels us to endure. Our life, suppose, is in the infinite. It cannot end. Its end is that life supreme. Death is a passage, not the goal of our walk. Some ancient deep impulsion labours on. Our souls are dragged as with a hidden leash, carried from birth to birth, from world to world. Our acts prolong after the body's fall, the old perpetual journey without pause. No silent peak is found where time can rest.
Thank you. In these lines, Shobindo's not making an absolute statement, but this is how it appears to Asvapati at this moment. He wants to escape from the kingdom of the greater life, and these deedle lines which life draws around us. This adjective comes from the name of Daedalus, who created the labyrinth for the Minotaur. He was a legendary ancient Greek architect and engineer. The king of Crete had to control this terrible monster, this Minotaur, this bull with a man's head, this hybrid being. And so he called Daedalus to create an underground labyrinth where that being lived. And we hear from the legends that he compelled his colonies, the other cities around the Mediterranean who owed tribute to him. He would, I think every 7 years, each of them had to send a boatload of young people and treasure tribute. So the story of Theseus, who became the king of Athens, tells that he volunteered to go along when the tribute was demanded, and he found a way to kill that Minotaur and destroy that whole system. There's also the story, which Shobindo refers to, the connected story of Daedalus and his son Icarus. after he'd built that labyrinth, he wanted to return to his home. You know, but Minos, the king of Crete, didn't allow him to leave because then he would spread the secrets and he wanted to control him where he was. So many of you will know this story probably, how Daedalus made wings for himself and his son, with feathered wings with wax. And very early one morning they set off to fly over the sea to the next island. And Daedalus warned his young son Icarus that don't fly too near the sun, don't fly too high, otherwise the rays of the sun will melt the wax of the wings. But the young fellow was so much enjoying flying that he flew too high and the wings melted and he plunged down into the sea and was drowned. So this is a kind of story with a moral, you know, don't try to fly too high. Daedal. So complicated, labyrinthine lines that we can't exactly see where they lead to. We can't find a way out. It's as if he's caught in that labyrinth of the greater life. He's looking for a way of escape. And he doesn't find a gate. He doesn't find a gate of horn, and he doesn't find any gate of ivory. We did some research about this on an earlier series of readings. These gates of horn and ivory appear in the epic, the Aeneid, the Latin epic by Virgil. And there the hero has to go underground, I think. And there he finds out that there are these gates to escape from the underworld. And they are the gates through which dreams escape into our world. The true dreams pass through the gates of ivory, and the false dreams pass to us through the gates of horn. But he doesn't find any kind of gate to escape from this world of life. He doesn't even find a little postern, a little narrow gate hidden at the back. That would be a way of spiritual sight that would allow him to escape. There was no issue, there was no way out from that dreamlike space. So that discovery gives the feeling that our being must move eternally through time. We may think that, oh, we die and then we go somewhere better, but death doesn't help us. The hope just to cease is in vain, because there's a secret will that's compelling us to go on, to endure, to continue. Our life can only find rest in the infinite. There's a beautiful prayer of St. Augustine who says to the Lord, you have made us for yourself, and we can't find any rest until we rest in you. Our life's repose is in the infinite. It cannot end. Its end is life supreme. So we are going to have to go on and be reborn and continue until we achieve that supreme life. Death is a passage. It's not the goal of our walk. This ancient, deep impulsion labors on, keeps us moving onwards. Even our souls are dragged against our will, as if we're being dragged by a hidden leash. A leash is what we make our dogs wear so that we can control them. We're carried from birth to birth, from world to world. And what we do in one life prolongs, makes continue after the body has fallen away, continues that old perpetual journey without pause. We don't find any silent peak, high place where time can rest. And pause. Yes?
You said this is not a statement by Sri Aurobindo.
No, I said this is not an absolute statement by Sri Aurobindo. He's not saying this is how things are. He says this is how we may feel. This is how Aswapati feels when he can't escape.
No? That means that Sri Aurobindo somewhere else feels something different. He believes into something.
Well, Aswapati will find an escape. Yeah, but here it's important for him to express this feeling that life gives us. How can we get out of this?
Yeah, because I told you it was an important passage.
Yes.
If it was expressing thought of Shelbindo. You're telling me that it's not so.
No, it's Shelbindo's expression of, as this whole book is, an expression of different psychological states. And this is one psychological state that the seeker, the serious seeker, may come to, experience. And we will see, we will have to move on to Canto 7. What Asvapati has to go through to find an escape. Yeah.
And when you were talking about this poem, it was the
Aeneid, yes.
It was Aeneas,
but whether he was the one who had this experience with the gate of horn and ivory, I can't quite remember. I'm sorry. Somebody must.
it was him. Yeah.
It was Aeneas. Yes.
Aeneas.
Thank you. Would you read on or again?
This was a magic stream that reached Gnosis. However far he went, wherever turned, the wheel of works ran with him and outstripped. Always the farther task was left to do. The beat of action and cry and a cry of search forever grew in that unquiet room. The busy murmur filled the heart of time. All was contrivance and unceasing stir. 100 ways to live were tried in vain. The sameness that assumed a thousand forms strove to escape from its long monotone and made new things that soon were like the curious decoration heard behind. And novel values furbished ancient themes, achieved the mind with the idea of change. A different picture that was still the same appeared on the cosmic vague background.
Thank you. Anyone has anything to share about this passage?
Contrivance.
It's ways of making things work, mechanical ways. It's artificial contrivances.
You contrive to do la-di-da, but it fails.
Sorry?
You contrive to do la-di-da, but it fails.
You fail, yes. Or you manage, but it's not the real thing. It's just artificial. So this is the kind of perception and feeling that makes people long for nirvana, for extinction. To outstrip means to overtake, to run faster than somebody.
That time is silliness that assumes a thousand forms.
Mm. A sameness, yes. It looks different. You think it's different. Oh, something new. But it's just the same old thing. A different picture, but it's still the same one. New values are used to dress up ancient themes, to cheat the mind with the idea of change. But it's not really change, it's just the same old thing, dressed up. Don, you would read?
A different picture that was still the same appeared upon the cosmic vague background. Only another labyrinthine house of creatures and their doings and events. A city of the traffic of bound souls. A market of creation and hardware was offered to the laboring mind and heart. A circuit ending where it first began is dubbed the forward and eternal march of progress on perfection's unknown road. Each final scheme leads to a sequel plan, yet every new departure seems the last. Inspired evangel, theory's ultimate peak, proclaiming a panacea for all time's ills, or carrying thought in its ultimate zenith flight. And trumpeting supreme discovery, each brief idea a structure perishable, publishes the immortality of its rule, its claim to be the perfect form of the truth's last epitome, time's golden best.
Thank you. Marianne, she would read on.
But nothing has been achieved for infinite work. The world with every and ever and never complete. Time always or half attempts on those attempts, and so is fragment as the eternal whole. In the endless mounting total of things, existence seemed a vain necessity that necessities act, a vessel of eternal opposites. In a clash, antagonism grows locked in place, a play without denouement. Or idea, a hunger march of life without a goal, or written on a bare blackboard of space, a futile and recurring sum of souls, the hope that failed, the light that never shone, the labor of an unaccomplished force tied to its act in a dim eternity.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. It sounds like miserable, doesn't it? Yeah. And if we see life like this, it is really miserable. Bharadwajan, would you go on?
No one man can get defeated. Although defeated, life must struggle on. Always she sees a crown she cannot grasp. Her eyes are fixed beyond her fallen stage. That poor still in her breast and ours, their glory is her own and is no more. That all flows from some unfulfilled beyond. That greatness is yet unleashed by the passing world. In a memory behind them, mortals and a dream that is of larger, happier air, living around three hearts of joy and love, forgotten by an immortal in love, a ghost of his pursuit and under that. All she remembers still, though now so far, a realm of golden dreams and glad desire, and the beauty and strength and happiness that were in the sweetness of a growing paradise, in a kingdom of immortal, halfway between God, silence, and darkness.
Thank you. This memory, he says, is quivering within her breast and ours. We share this memory of a glory that was once and is no more. And it may express itself in us as an aspiration for some, or a dream, or a vision of some unfulfilled beyond, a greatness yet unreached by the halting world. He says it's a memory, a dream persisting of a larger, happier air, forgotten by us, immortal in lost time.
What is that that's lost?
Well, we read right at the beginning of Canto 3, no? You remember. I hope you all remember. He describes the state of life as we know it. But then he says, on page 118, line 86, yet pure and bright from the timeless was her birth. A lost world rapture lingers in her eyes. Her moods are faces of the infinite. Beauty and happiness are her native right, and endless bliss is her eternal home. That's the true source of life. And he has told us also why we are not experiencing life like this. That also comes in Canto 3, at the end of Canto 3. He tells us how, when this world was just forming, it was a purely material world. Within that matter, there were spirits, there were divine beings who were longing for higher possibilities than matter alone offered. And they called to life to come, and she came, hoping to fill a fair new world with bliss. This great and wide-winged angel poured all her beauty into the material world. But then, as has happened with each successive power that has descended from above, it gets swallowed up by the lower realities, swallowed up by matter. And so life has had to struggle up from these very dark beginnings, which we read about in Canto 4, all the different levels of life, the emergence of life. And so that darkness and all those primitive experiences, sufferings, impulses, all that's clinging around us still. And but we can't, like life, we can't step out of this process. We've accepted to be part of the evolutionary process. Our souls have accepted to be part, and so we have to go along with it. And what Asvapati is doing is searching for a principle that will be able to free us from this labyrinth of life, whether it's the little life or the greater life. What is that power that will be able to make the earthly life a divine life? That is his mission. So he's only halfway through it. And now he's going to have to pass through a very, very difficult phase of that journey. But let's read on. Fanny, would you read?
Mm-hmm. in a hidden part within, awake to a vague mystery within. We meet a deep, unseen reality, thought through on the world's face of present truth. We are chased by a self we cannot now recall, and moved by a spirit we must still become. As one who has lost the kingdom of his soul, we look back to some God face of our birth, other than this imperfect creature here, and hope in this or divine world to recover yet from heaven's patient guard. What by our mind's forgetfulness we miss, our being's natural felicity, our heart's delight, we have exchanged for grief, the body's thrill we bartered for mere pain, the bliss for which our mortal nature yearns, as yearns an obscure moth to blaze in light.
Thank you. I think it's clear, no? Prasad, you like to read?
Our life is a march to victory never won. This way of being, longing for delight, this eager turmoil of unsatisfied strengths, these long, far fights of forward striving hopes, lift worshipping eyes to the blue void called heaven, looking for the golden hand that never came, the advent for which all creation waits, the beautiful visage of eternity that shall appear upon roads of time. Yet still to ourselves we say, rekindling faith, oh, surely one day ye shall come to our cry. One day ye shall create our life anew and utter the magic formula of peace and bring perfection to the scheme of things. One day ye shall descend to life and earth, leaving the secrecy of the eternal doors into the world that cries to him for help, and bring the truth that sets the spirit free, the joy that is the baptism of the soul, the strength that is the outstretched arm of love. One day he shall lift his beauty's dreadful veil, impose delight on the world's beating heart, and bear his secret body of light and bliss.
Thank you. Line 967. Still to ourselves we say, rekindling faith. These are the things we are. Well, yeah, we rekindle our faith with these words. Yeah.
One question. So here he describes the trance that is the outstretched arm of love.
Yes. We have the feeling that love is not powerful enough, you know, to solve all the problems. Love may be there. It comes in another part of the poem, the divine love and pity, that Madonna. She says, I was born to solace, not to save. I don't have the power to save. And then Savitri promises her that one day I will return, and then you will have wisdom and strength, and everything will be changed. But now we strain to reach an unknown goal. There is no end of seeking and of birth. There is no end of dying and return. The life that wins its aim asks greater aims. The life that fails and dies must live again. Till it has found itself, it cannot cease. All must be done for which life and death were made. But who shall say that even then is rest? Or there repose and action are the same in the deep breast of God's supreme delight. In a high state where ignorance is no more, each movement is a wave of peace and bliss. Repose, God's motionless creative force. Action, a ripple in the infinite, and birth, a gesture of eternity. Poonam, will you read?
A sun of transfiguration still can shine, and night can bear its coal of mystic light. The self-canceling, self-afflicting paradox into a self-luminous mystery might change. The imbroglio into a joyful miracle, then God could be visible here. Here take a shape, disclosed would be the spirit's identity. Life would reveal her true immortal face. But now a termless labor is her fate. In its recurrent decimal of events, births, deaths are ceaseless iteration spines. The old question mark margins each finished page, each volume of her efforts history, a limping yes to the eon's journey still, accompanied by an eternal no. All seems in vain, yet endless is the game, impassive turns the ever-circling wheel. Life has no issue, death brings no relief. A prisoner of itself, the being lives and keeps its futile immortality. Extinction is denied, its soul escape. An error of the gods has made the world, or indifferent the eternal watches time.
Thank you.
I just tell you, I love so much of their report and action of the same mother. The deep breaths of God's supreme glory.
Yes.
I'm always touched by this, a limping yes and an eternal no. That we can say that so much dominating our existence, that we are more conscious of it.
So what is King Asvapati going to do now? He's climbed up the stair this far to the heights of the greater life, and he's found that it doesn't give an answer. It doesn't give that power that he's looking for, that is missing. Yeah?
This last line, these two last lines.
Yes.
The first one has a full stop. Oh,
yes.
And then another one again has a full stop.
Yeah.
But it seems they are connected.
It seems they are connected. You are right. An error of the gods has made the world. And he puts the full stop because that's a conclusion that we come to. No. Oh, and then there's an additional line. Oh, and it's more or less the same thing. Indifferent. The eternal watches time. But of course, Asvapati knows that this is not so. He knows that he has to continue, but where and how is he going to continue? So if we just look back at page 135, there's a break. And before the break, there's very, very pathetic lines about life. In nescience began her mighty task. In ignorance she pursues the unfinished work. For ignorance gropes, but meets not wisdom's face. Ascending slowly with unconscious steps, a foundling of the gods, she wanders here, like a child's soul left near the gates of hell, fumbling through fog in search of paradise. And then after the break, it tells us that in this slow ascension of life, as she's fumbling through fog in search of paradise with no clear light to guide her, he, Asvapati, must follow her pace, even from her faint and dim subconscious star. So only can Earth's last salvation come. He has to go back to the beginning and find out what has happened. For so only could he know the obscure cause of all that holds us back and baffles God in the jail delivery of the imprisoned soul. Along swift paths of fall, through dangerous gates, he chanced into a gray obscurity, teeming with instincts from the mindless gulfs that push to wear a form and win a place. Life here was intimate with death and night, and ate death's food that she might breathe a while. She was their inmate and adopted waif, accepting subconscious in dumb darkness reign, a sojourner she hoped not anymore. There, far away from truth and luminous thought, he saw the original seat the separate birth of the dethroned, deformed, and suffering power, an unhappy face of falsity made true. A contradiction of our divine birth, indifferent to beauty and to light, parading, she flaunted her animal disgrace, unhelped by camouflage, brutal and bare, an authentic image, recognized and signed of her outcast force, exiled from heaven and hope, fallen, glorying in the vileness of her state. So we haven't come to that yet, but now we are going to come to it. Here, Asvapati realizes that he has to descend and make this exploration, and this is what he will see. So we have to pass through two very difficult cantos now, Canto 7 and Canto 8. The descent into night, and then this...
Your article talks about negative yoga.
Yes.
This is to be described as a negative yoga, descent into night?
I don't think so. Of course, what he experiences is very dreadful, but Asvapati keeps within him this flame of his spirit, yes. And because of that, he's able to emerge the other side. I don't know what Sri Aurobindo meant by negative yoga. I'd have to have a look where that phrase appears.
But if you see what in this chapter, what is missing, that he comes to this conclusion. What is missing from Asvapati, so that he comes to the conclusion on error of the gods as well?
I don't think he really comes to that conclusion, but that's the feeling that many people come to. No.
I see, but on the other hand, you can look, okay, what could he be missing?
Yes, what is missing is that way out to a higher state. Wherever he looks, he can't find a way out, no? Death is not the way. So what is the way out? That is what he has to find now. And in order to find it, it seems that he has to go to the very roots of what is wrong with life. The deformation, how has it happened? Where has it come from? Why is that evil at the roots of life? Where has it come from? So perhaps we can start by reading Canto 7. Patty, will you start?
In Canto 7, the descent of the night, a mind absolved from life, made calm to know, a heart divorced from the blindness and the pang, the seal of tears, the bond of ignorance. He turned to find that wide world failure's cause. Away he looked from nature's visible face and sent his gaze into the viewless vast, formidable, unknown infinity, asleep behind the endless coil of things that carries the universe in its timeless breadths, and the ripples of its being are our lives. The worlds are built by its unconscious breath, and matter and mind are its figures or its powers, our waking thoughts the output of its dreams. The veil was rent that covers nature's depths. He saw the fount of the world's lasting pain and the mouth of the black pit of ignorance. The evil guarded at the roots of life raised up its head and looked into his eyes. On the dim bank where dies subjective space, from a stark ridge overlooking all that is, a tenebrous awakened nescience, her wide blank eyes wondering at time and form, stared at the inventions of the living void and the abyss whence our beginnings rose. Behind appeared a gray carved mask of night, watching the birth of all created things, a hidden puissance conscious of its force, a vague and lurking presence everywhere. A contrary doom that threatens all things made, a death figuring as the dark seed of life seemed to engender and enslave the world.
Thank you. Jerry?
Then, from the somber mystery of the eyes, and from the horror blossom of the mask, something crept forth that seemed a shapeless form, fatal influence of unreachable storm, whose lethal touch crushed the immortal spirit. On life was laid the hounding finger of death, and overcast the error we
naked will produce and joy and light. Deformation, void has claimed to be the being's very germ, nature's true life. A hostile and perverting mind has run every corner and sconces of conscious life. Corrupted truths with their own formulas, interceptor of the listening of the soul. Afflicting knowledge with the view of doubt. It touches the oracle of the occult gods, effaced the signposts of life's pilgrimage, cancelled the firm rock habits created by time, and on the foundations of the cosmic law, erected in bronze spines of misrule.
Thank you. Will you read, please?
Even light and love, by that cloak danger's spell, turn from the brilliant nature of the gods to fallen angels and misleading sons, became themselves a danger and a charm, a perverse sweetness, heaven-born malefice. Its power could deform divinest things. A wind of sorrow breathed upon the world. All thought with falsehood was besieged, all act stamped with defect or with frustration sign. All high attempt with failure or vain success, but none could know the reason of his fall. The gray mass whispered, and, though no sound was heard, yet in the ignorant heart a seed was sown that bore black fruit of suffering, death, and failed. Out of the chill steps of a bleak, unseen, invisible, wearing the night's gray mask, arrived the shadowy, dreadful messengers, invaders from a dangerous world of power, ambassadors of evil's absolute. In silence the inaudible voices spoke, hands that none saw planted the fatal grain. No form was seen, yet a dire work was done, an iron decree in crooked uncials written, imposed a law of sin and adverse fate.
Thank you.
Light looked at him with changed and somber eyes. Her beauty he saw, and the erring heart in things, that with a little happiness in his content, answering to a small ray of truth or love, he saw her gold sunlight and her far blue sky, her green of leaves and hue and scent of flowers, and the charm of children and the love of friends, and the beauty of women and kindly hearts of men, but saw too the dreadful powers that drive her most, and the anguish she has strewn upon her ways, fate waiting on the unseen steps of man, and her evil and sorrow and last gift of death, a breath of disillusion and decadence, corrupting watch for life's maturity, and made to rot the full grain of the soul. Progress became a purveyor of death.
Thank you. Ravi, you're right.
A world that clung to the law of a stained life, cherished the
putrid
cut sense of dead truths, held twisted forms as things free, new and true, beauty from an evil trunk, filling themselves against utter banquet of the gods, and tasted corruption like a high priced food, a darkness settled on the heavy air. It haunted the bright smile from nature's lips and slew the native confidence in her heart, and put fierce crooked look into her eyes. The lost that her words, the spirit's natural good, replaced by her manufactured virtue and vice, the frank, spontaneous impulse of the soul, afflicting nature with the dual's lie, their twin values, waited a forbidden zest, made evil or relief from spurious God, spurious good, the ego battened on righteousness and sin, and each became an instrument of hell. In rejected heaps by a monotonous road, the old simple delights were left to lie on the resonant of life's descent to night. All glory of life was dimmed, tarnished with doubt,
All beauty ended in an aging face. All power was stopped. All tyranny crossed by God. And truth of fiction needed by the mind. The chase of joy was now a tired haunt. All knowledge was left for questioning ignorance.
Manoha.
As from a womb obscure, he saw emerge the body and visage of a dark unseen, hidden behind the fair outsides of life. Its dangerous commerce is our suffering's cause. Its breath is a subtle poison in man's heart. All evil starts from that ambiguous face, a peril hunted now the common air. The world grew full of menacing energy. And wherever turned for help or hope his eyes, in field and house, in street and camp and mart, he met the proud and stealthy come and go of armed, disgusting bodies' influences. The march of goddess figures, there, dark and mute, around the air with grandiose unease. Pallid footsteps grew invisibly near, shapes that were threats invaded the dream light, and ominous beings passed him on board, whose very gaze was a calamity. Charm and sweetness, sudden and formidable, faces that raised alluring lips and eyes, approached him, armed with beauty like a snare, but hid a fatal meaning in each line, and could in a moment dangerously change. But he alone discerned and screened attack. A veil upon the inner vision lay. A force was there that hid its dreadful steps. All was belied, yet thought itself. All were beset but knew not of the siege, for none could see the authors of their fall.
Thank you. Gani.
Aware of some dark wisdom, still within a back of the scene and well of his friends, he followed the track of the tremendous steps, returning to the night from which the track he reached unveiled and owned by no one. There all could enter, but no one stayed for long. It was a no man's land of Edinburgh, a crowded neighborhood without one home, a borderland between the world and hell. There in reality was nature's law. It was a space where nothing could be true, for nothing was what it had claimed to be. A high appearance wrapped a spacious world. Yet nothing would confess its own pretense, even to itself in the ambiguous heart. A vast deception was the law of things. Only by that deception they could live. An unsubstantial meaning guaranteed the falsehood of the forms this nature took, and made them seem a while to be and live. The borrowed magic moved them from the void. They took the shape and stuff that was not theirs, and showed a color that they could not keep. Mirrors to a phantasm of reality.
Thank you. Will you read?
It is endless. Brilliance was a splendid night. A view to angel dust, a glamour fest. Nothing could be wrong, nothing could be right. On pulling, turn up the tears and God and eat bread, but never out of it. Don't start the good, love and that early in hand, delight till with pain. Truth into falsity, live and death, good plan. A power that love, tear the mysteries of the world, an irony that joined the world's contrary and flung them into each other's arms to struggle. Saturnic dipped us on God's face, allowed its influence, entered a desire, and left the golden forth not on the face, a twisted heart, and a strange sinless smile, not as the sinister comedy of life.
Thank you. Tomoko.
Listen for God. wisdom, with virtue through the soul, and led to perdition by the heavenward path. A lavish sense he gave of power and joy, and when arose the warning from within, he reassured the ear with dulcet tones, or took the mind captive in its own need. His rigorous logic made the false thing true. Amazing the elect with holy rule, he spoke as with the very voice of God.
Thank you. Will you read?
The air was full of treachery and rule. Truth speaking was a stratagem in that place. Ambush lurked in a smile and peril me. Safety its cover, trust its entry key. Falsehood came laughing with the eyes of each friend might turn an enemy or spy. The hand unclasped and sleeved a dagger stab, and an embrace could be doomed. Fine cage. Agony and danger stalked their trembling prey, and softly spoke as to a timid friend. Attacks ran suddenly, vehement and unseen. Fear leaped upon the heart at every turn, and cried out with an anguished, dreadful voice. It called for one to save, but none came near. All verily wrought, for death was ever close. Yet caution seemed a vain sense of care, for all that guarded proved a deadly net. And when, after long suspense, salvation came and brought a glad relief, disarming strength, it served as a smiling passage to worse fate. There was no truce and no safe place to rest. One dared not slumber or put off one's arm. It was a world of battle and surprise. All who were there lived for themselves alone. All warred against all, but with common hate turned on the mind that sought some hide. Truth was exiled, lest she should dare to speak, and hurt the heart of darkness with her light, or bring her pride of knowledge to blaspheme the settled anarchy of established things.
Thank you. I think we will stop there for today.
Thanks to Sherwin.